As intention grows through direct experience, then a factor that we hear about called faith arises. And faith is not in any way an emotional experience, so to speak, within the technical understanding of faith. It's the recognition of that which works and how it works in a manner that's born of, again, something we hear about called direct experience. And the direct experience that is referred to here is the moment where, at the moments, where there's a shift in orientation and therefore in a perceptual experience as a result of a sudden alignment of many factors that we're cultivating inadvertently that allow for just the receptivity of that which is in a manner that has no content and no context. No context, no content. Because it's not about anything. It's a tolerance for a certain factor that allows for other factors to mature. What we're doing in approximating the practice, as there's greater humility and malleability and the increasing receptivity, is thinking. And I was fortunate in that my transition from other trainings to Buddhism, which was first in Zen, was attended to by a very, very committed Dhamma being called Sansanin. And he asked me to come live with him, not just with him per se, but in very close, everyday overviewing kind of training. So I couldn't get away with very much, but you bet I got away with much more than I think he thought. than I think he thought. He knew. I'm still getting away with things. Or at least that's what I think. Because thinking is deceptive. It's about getting away from and with. It's sneaky the way our attention gets captivated by thinking, right? Something arises and it's just, it's very challenging. Even if we have a clear appreciation and some degree of a very foundational, practical understanding of this practice, we still want to dream it because we still want it to be about the self. We just do. That's just a habit. And the habit has a lot of momentum. And as that factor of equanimity grows with the approximation of our attention into this receptivity that just is capable of direct experience without that secondary wanting anything from it, then this is the tolerance as well for what's referred to as panya. We learn to tolerate the fruits of our practice. Whereas we think that we're heading for a paradise where they're just going to be everywhere around us and we're going to be eating them off the tree, you know? And in a certain way, this is the return to the garden, but the garden already exists here and we're lost looking for it, so to speak. This lifetime is an opportunity to gather the force of the energy that we call the mind. We cannot know what mind is. No one will ever know what mind is. And it is not mind that we are applying. It's not mind that is the critical factor. It is not mind that we are in effectively negotiating with is attention, which is the only aspect of what we call consciousness that is free to apply with change. So that as a result of mindful awareness and that alignment that happens to culmination over time of certain factors that allows for it to be enough for just one moment of this receptivity with what is without even putting it within context, is the tolerance that counterbalances the wanting that consumes everything, everything. The wanting consumes everything. I was listening to a brilliant dialogue between two brilliant people, both who have a certain mission, and that is to tell us about what's really going on in the world in terms of what's really happening rather than democracy. And as I was listening, I thought to myself, well, contextually that's interesting, but whatever you call it, whether democracy or what, whatever we call it that we think idealistically can actually exist within our human perceptual process, within ourselves and amongst ourselves, is always being interrupted by greed, ill will, and delusion. And if we think this is different back in some story that we have about indigenous people in the forest of Amazon 200 years ago, the truth of the matter is that we, as breathing beings, become more and more idealistic in a way. And we see the ideals, and our transition is from ideology to cultivation of that which counterbalances all of those forces that belie our deepest intentions and disallow our maturation of that which is unbinding, free. And it becomes disillusioning over and over again that we're alone in it. Because only one person can cultivate that which is within the capacity of human consciousness that brings about the experience of the unbinding from the identification with greed, ill will, and delusion. We need to be awake to the degree that we are awake in a way that is practical and recognize that we're still preoccupied. We're still bound. We're still creating new dreams about how it could be. You know, if everybody practiced mindfulness, then we'd have a different world. Well, that's never going to happen. Because it takes a certain interest, and then it takes a very, very, very long period of patience and tolerance and diligence to engage that which mindfulness represents as an opportunity. In this life, what is possible is that we're getting clear about how to work with change, how to work with impermanence, how to work with the potential sensibilities that arise as a result of the increasing capacity to recognize the ideological process and basically bring our attention into what's called bhavana, which is the cultivation of that which we hold idealistically. One of the challenges in our practice as the approximation of mindfulness occurs is that we do let go of our preoccupation with the other. Because the other is just oftentimes we might find, see, recognize. I can say this as a mother of five. I can say this as someone who's getting older and older all the time and getting verifications of certain things all the time. That most of the time the other is just a mirror in which we're projecting. And one of the very challenging aspects in the approximation of the cultivation of mindfulness is that if we keep it within the framework of the other, then it's not even possible to get underneath the surface, so to speak, or within the actual direct experience, where what begins to grow in terms of these culminating factors is that which is not personal. We want it to be personal, but it's not. It manifests personally, but it is not personal. As an example, this may sound awfully strange, but the idealistic qualities that we hold and we could have conferences about from here and to ever more, agreeing that, yes, it's good, you know, kindness is good. Dalai Lama says it's natural, but that doesn't mean that we operate out of kindness. We don't even know what it is. We don't know what kindness is. We don't know what love is. Can we get real? We hold as an ideal. But most of the time, if we're really using the awakening reflective power of consciousness in the approximation of the practice, the preoccupation isn't in what those factors that we begin to recognize as kindness. Sometimes they are. These operative factors that lend themselves to a perceptual experience where, yes, oh, this is what kindness is, as opposed to, oh, look what a kind person I was in that moment. We look for these idealizations in others, and we can't hear, we don't want to hear. We don't want to hear, as an example, to the Dalai Lama that he's just a human being. You know, that he's not some transcendent being, that he just, you know, he has a whole certain values that he attends to. And he holds them for those who are interested, but that doesn't mean that those around him are interested. There isn't some magical process going on, just a human being who has a lot of responsibility and holds that responsibility within the framework of the middle path. And holds that responsibility within the framework of the development of the paramis. And holds that responsibility within the framework of what he refers to as logic. Come on, let's wake up. Let's just get logical. Let's look at cause and effect, at what works and what doesn't work. So yesterday was about the clarification of that. How does this work? From a place of humility, and the dialogue, as we began to close, was so sort of kind of simple and yet luminous in terms of the recognition of what can occur when one is in the process of bhavana, or cultivation. We're still wanting that which actually we will eventually surrender our attention to cultivate. And the term bhavana is the missing term in the conveyance of the suggestions of the Buddha in terms of how to make sense out of life, in terms of maturing our consciousness. What we can do is mature our consciousness, and then within the maturation of that consciousness, there are certain capacities that exist that otherwise don't exist, because in that maturation is not, the sense of self is no longer the reference point for everything. We don't have to go back into conference with self that only knows fear and aversion. Everything just gets lost in that duality. And then we have to go back to the self. This is a profound and challenging practice, and it's a lot of fun when we get a hang of it, when we see how simple it is, because that simplicity offers ease. We're trying to survive, and we're using the practice to try to survive. We're striving. we're projecting the wanting mind into our practice. We project it onto everything else, and it hasn't worked. So here we are projecting it into our practice, this relationship that finally we return to out of the recognition. It said at first that faith is dim, you know, so there's a sense of faith, but the projection onto the practice is what it is that we experience that hasn't worked in projection upon anything else. But because we're in the realm of Dhamma, that begins to dispel. The projections are seen as projections over time. As well, the projections are seen in terms of their causes. And then over time as well, the projections are just seen as empty. And the reason that they're experienced as empty is because there's an underlying factor that is operative within the approximation of the practice, which we cannot weigh or measure or think, which is called anatta. It's a characteristic of process orientation rather than self. So this process of perception begins to occur in a way that allows for that sense. It isn't a cognitive sense, oh, this is empty. But the interest factor is no longer roused. And I think that we can enjoy that contemplation of all and of that which heretofore was interesting that doesn't draw our interest anymore. Not because we have said it's bad, go away, which is what we're holding still in terms of a habitual delusionary way of approaching things, but because it just falls away. It falls away. The things that, I mean, I look back at that young woman and what in the world was she doing? You know? It's like it makes sense within compassion, but it doesn't make sense other than to recognize it was just an experiment, all of it. From the time that one individuates even slightly, blessed be that we're allowed to individuate. That we do have these wills that project and create separation from the mother body. And then we go into reactivity. You know, get away, become an individual. I'm going to fulfill this wanting, right? And that's what she was doing. And these endless experiments of fulfilling the wanting without even knowing that the wanting was driving the process. And the only recognition of change was through disillusionment and disenchantment. And this is what Shakyamuni said, that this is the path of disillusionment and disenchantment, of the wanting. Until there's the culmination of certain factors through mindful awareness that just recognize the sensations of wanting, the impulses of wanting, associated with wanting, and the manifestations of it, the machinations of it, out of the real true interest of recognizing that it's empty. It's an impulse that drives every moment of our existence within the framework of that which can be known. Until we recognize it, for it is clearly stated that the root cause of suffering, the root cause of suffering is the ignorance of craving, which is wanting, clinging and grasping. We get caught in asking why a lot. Why? Why am I still holding on to that which is not wholesome? Well, why doesn't go anywhere? Eventually that becomes empty. So this is to say I could go on and on and on about the reflections of this incredibly clarifying process that occurs in moments that then eventually allow for the sense of upeka, the sense of upeka, the equanimity factor that arises out of each moment of sati, translated as mindfulness, is to participate in cultivating that which matures the consciousness so as to be able to extricate attention from that which is preoccupying, this ignorance, and apply it in just here and now, this body breathing, and other skill and means. But the truth is, and we can be so honest, it's not enough. It's not enough. We're all here wanting more. And we're all here in devastation that we can't get it. And we're all here holding on. And eventually, the disillusionment and disenchantment occur. It just does. One way I look at the cultivation of sati is that it is a non-crisis-oriented way of registering actuality. Because otherwise we rely upon crisis. The distinction between what I want and what I hold and what I grasp and the actuality of change. Boom. And I'm forced to let go. There's a beautiful story of this that we will hear over and over again about a woman and that whose child died, and the grief was so profound and the inability to accept the death was so overwhelming that she went mad. And in the madness, held the child with the belief that somehow it was just sleeping. Just sleeping. And for days was begging, help me, help me, help me wake my child. And then heard of a great healer called Shakyamuni. And oh, maybe this is the person that knows how to wake my child up. And went and begged, my child is asleep and I need your medicine. I need your help. So Shakyamuni said, well, I will wake your child back up if you go to the near village and go to every door and bring me a mustard seed from an abode where there is someone living in the abode that hasn't experienced what you're going through. Bring me this mustard seed. So this person, driven by grief and holding on, did so with the dead child in her arms and came back and put the child down in front of this healer and said, I understand. I understand that my grief, the truth of impermanence, the passing and rising and passing of life is a natural process. So it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. And that's in part one of our delusionary beliefs. And just know this, you know, as we get to know delusion, we can be more friendly with it, that somehow life is supposed to be pleasurable. And yet, we are practitioners within the field of guidance held by the turning of the wheel of Dhamma for this era of being, where the teachings are all just emanations out of what's referred to as the Four Noble Truths of Suffering. If somebody were to ask me, are you a Buddhist? I would say, I'm a student of the First Noble Truth. I don't know what it means to be a Buddhist. We don't live in a Buddhist culture. We are inspired. But, you know, if you ever lived in Asia and see what a Buddhist is, you know, it's a different kind of orientation. I was raised in Asia, so I had that understanding to some degree, just sort of part of my karmic awareness. We are practical. we see that these teachings and these practices are responses to something deep within, some sense. This is called the sense of path. And as we become more practical about this and recognize that our initial instruction from get-go, if we ever had initial instruction, was initial application of attention and sustained application of attention. And that's what we did yesterday. We really clarified this for ourselves. Within a limited time of a day. Because what we can do is really begin to hold this in a kind of discernment between that which doesn't work and that which does work. I don't know what your motivation is in terms of how that's framed. I don't know what you want from the practice that you haven't gotten from any other relationship that you've experienced. But meanwhile, all that's fading away. And there are these lucid moments when actually all there is just sensation and breathing. And with this, there is extraordinary sense of subtleties of qualities of consciousness arise. Just moments of calm. Someone yesterday acknowledged calm was not something that this person wanted to maintain. The person didn't trust it. We don't trust the fruits of the practice yet. This is why we have Sangha. Because there's something that knows the way, but is obscured. But we keep being informed and animated by it. It brings our bodies here. We keep remembering intention. I had suggested on Thursday evening that, you know, maybe we could form the intention to remember before we enter the door to cultivate mudita. Yesterday as I came in, I forgot. I saw Fred's face and he was waiting for me. I got a little bit lost, so I called him. And I was so touched by his clarity in terms of logistics of whatever I wanted to thank him. Yeah, just that. But then the next time I went out and came back in, I remembered. Today, as I was walking towards, I was looking at the raked pebbles, thinking, what kind of pebbles are those? Oh, look at the lighting then, how they da-da-da. And then I got to the door, and in that moment, intention arose that I remembered. Right to the door as my nose was almost there. It's like, you know, and it arose. It's like this, and I was so grateful. This is what we can do. We can intend and be grateful when that which we intend and therefore have cultivated arises naturally. Where'd this come from? This isn't a part of the ego framework. A moment of mindfulness. As I walked in, the lilies are blooming. Yesterday they were closed, right here. And they're very pungent, aren't they? Can you smell them? The fragrance associated with, sometimes referred to as the taste of Dhamma, occurs upon those moments of just sudden receptivity where everything is the same. Good and bad are the same. Pleasure and pain are the same. This is what was shared yesterday. Moments where that which seemed to be opposite seemed to be the same. Our practice is reconfiguring everything within us from a level of DNA, cellular, biochemical, neurologic, everything. It's reframing, it's reconditioning. And we sit on the little tippy top of our little, you know, mountain, which is just the top of the iceberg, you know, the 1 or 2% of consciousness, waiting for it to happen without even knowing what it is. Here, in the practice, we get glimpses that draw our attention more into a kind of permeation with the experience of breathing. And in these moments, what we experience is just that sense of true, just true, non-contextual, true like the compass that becomes still when the direction has been set, has been established, true. This is true. This is of course. This is of path. And increasing faith that this underlying sense of path does exist within our human consciousness and underlies everything. Everything. We experience this sense of true, not truth, true. When there's a continuity of mindfulness that is maintained in transition from posture to posture. Because the continuity is the sameness, and that which is true arises in the thoroughness by which we literally experience the continuity of something as simple as just placing one's foot. Because there's a holding away from everything. So even just the experience of like allowing the weight of the body consciously in the stages of the lifting, placing the foot, just allow for it to surrender, then suddenly there's a sense of balance there. And that balance is the point by which and from which we experience lawfulness. And that which is lawful is that we are being held here by the force of gravity. And one of the things that happens in the practice is that we come out of the sky of the mind into the force field of the interplay of all these elemental factors that exist when we are here and now, within a moment. There's a relief, a relaxation of something that is holding everything away. But it doesn't register in the personal sense of self and emotion. It registers just as true. If it becomes truth, and I teach Dhamma or reflect Dhamma out of this is what's true, this is what's, you know, then it becomes ideological and tyrannical. Before I suggest that we just spend some time with that which is true, and you know, in terms of the truth of the importance of our practice, in this manner that is related to its kagada, just this, and as well direct experience. I'd like to just refer to the Kalama Sutta for a moment, which I would love to spend some time with you contemplating at some point. Because there are these people who are confused. They live in a village. Maybe that village is called Albuquerque. They are the Kalamas owing to their village. And they're confused because there are all these different venerables coming and saying, this is the way, this is the way, this is the way. But there's something missing. And so the question that arises upon this other venerable, just another one, Shakyamuni, you know, everybody was walking around in those days, walking around, you know, going from grove to grove and whatever, meeting people, just that. They said, oh, another venerable. Oh, let us ask you our collective question. How do we discern that which is true? When everybody else is telling us what's true, but it doesn't seem true, And the factor associated with that that seems to be a deterrent is that everybody seems to own the truth and therefore become derisive of others' truths. In Pali, that term that's identified and translated that way is called the breaking of the wings. In breaking of the wings, so that sense of, you know, the two-winged birds, the two wings of the, you know, of Buddhism are broken, you know, compassion, wisdom, and an interplay within consciousness, they're broken. So we feel broken in listening to this derisive kind of power play that everyone has about, I know the truth, and I actually know somebody who is saying, and this question is very compelling to a lot of people, I've been a monk, I've been a Theravadin person, and I know the truth about the Satipatthana Sutra and nobody else does. It's very compelling. A lot of people are going because this person knows the truth. Right? Anybody that tells you they know the truth about anything? Just say, oh, okay. And continue on your way. Because the true mind is poised and don't know. So Shakyamuni says, I really understand and commiserate with your confusion because these are the conditions that lead to confusion. So let us consider together, are we over-reliant upon certain things? Where is our attention going? What are we looking towards in order to find this truth, which is just a subtle sensibility within? Are we looking towards that which is bound, scripture or commentary, or are we looking towards that? Are we looking, you know, towards, and on goes this is a list. But finally, saying, are you looking towards the authority of another? Is there something that says, oh, this is my teacher, and therefore I don't have to do the work? This person knows and can transmit Shakti. Oh, did you get it? Excuse me, I get overwhelmed with Shakti sometimes. Maybe you got it, but anyway, it goes away. You know, it's just like, and then this is where we hear this nugget that gets compromised a lot. This is where the Kalama Sutta ends. There actually are five sections to it. It ends with, in terms of conveyance, see for yourself what is true. Well, how do you do that? The Kalama Sutta goes on to say, in accordance with the distinction between that which is wholesome and not, how do we cultivate that? And it goes on to kind of frame for us a manner by which we can begin to cultivate that which has the capacity to know the distinction between and amongst the wisdom, the knowing, aligned with the sense of power. And therefore to cultivate that which is wise, and practical. And applicable. Experimentally engaged. Because the core of sati is held within two factors. Number one, sati is mindfulness. Number one is heedfulness. That which knows begins to be heedful of the distinction. When heedfulness arises, then that is the gift of sati, of mindfulness. If that which is wholesome arises, then shift attention to it. Skillful effort. And then the second emanation or nuance of sati is participatory awareness. Our placing our attention and receptivity with what is a result of this active functionary of awareness called attention. Be heedful of that which is, and participate through bhavana and cultivation with that which is wholesome. The self cannot determine. It's a sensibility. One can contemplate, but the habits and the conditions are still here that draw our attention back into the manifestation of that which is not wholesome. And that's just the way it is. The beauty of the knowing within this hopefully ever-humbling being is just recognizing that this is the basis of Dhamma. That which knows, recognizing that which is suffering. Knowing that that which knows is not suffering. Engaging that which actually cultivates that which is unbinding. The awareness of breathing in this moment that might be vaguely apparent can be brought into a more heightened awareness through just receiving these sensations with gratitude. Because they are here. They're here. And knowing them in awareness, heedful, and in a participatory receptivity moment to moment, and when not, simply returning. Our life is our practice. Life is occurring through this motion and movement of breathing. We are learning to create and cultivate an understanding and an application that allows for our practice to be maintained, lived, breathed from the inside out. And in doing so, just check for yourself if it feels that this is true, not because I have said anything, because I am an experimenter as well, but because it's your own direct experience. Knowing the distinction in any moment it's possible between thinking, imaging, and just a sense of receptivity with sensation, then allows for the continuity of the awareness within a sensory continuity, and will not simply return. Requires effort, patience. It doesn't matter what else is occurring. It's not a right or wrong. It's a discernment. It's knowing the distinction. And not focusing per se, but opening with. Opening to the direct experience of sensation. With sensation. It is possible. Returning. We are Dhamma friends. There's no separation between us if we recognize this, that this is what we can be. And today, this topic of our practice is our life, and our sense of practice, and the clarifying sense of practice that comes, becomes the basis of inquiry, and therefore of Dhamma reflection. I am fortunate, personally, to have mentors. Mentors are those who have dedicated their life to practice. We practice together, and I inquire. It's an ongoing process. Of clarification. Questions come up for me like flowers. They go on a list. And in the auspicious moment of being present with one of my mentors, I inquire. This is so interesting. Let's be together in this experience of interest. Let's engage. Let's be heedful. Let's be interested. There may be questions. Let's reflect together. What are you experiencing in your practice? And you might say, well, I'm too young in practice and to ask a question, but we're all just in kindergarten.